I have in the book some images of scribes from the ancient world sitting cross-legged looking at their tablets, and when I squint, they look very much like my students sitting cross-legged in the library looking at their tablets.
Welcome to Cambridge Forum in Harvard Square. Tonight we have a captivatingly attractive topic: storytelling and how it shaped the world. I'm Mary Stack, the director of Cambridge Forum, and tonight we are delighted to have as our speaker an expert raconteur himself, Professor Martin Puchner, who recently published The Written World. Martin Puchner has accomplished an amazingly tricky task in this latest book. He has surveyed about 4,000 years worth of stories. Martin Puchner is a professor of English and comparative literature at Harvard and editor of the Norton Anthology of World Literature. He's read an awful lot of stories. Good evening to Professor Puchner and welcome.
So I'm going to take you on a romp through literary history, 4,000 years of it, and as with all stories, it's good to start the story of literature at the very beginning. Now, it's very hard to know what happened at the very beginning. It's often a kind of retrospective reconstruction. But here's a story that was told by Mesopotamian scribes in what's today Iraq about 4,000 years ago about how their ancestors invented writing. The first writing system emerged in Mesopotamia about 5,000 years ago. And this is how Mesopotamian scribes themselves told the story of that origin. The story is set in the town of Uruk. It imagines a king of Uruk hoping to subdue a rival king, the king of the mountain realm of Arata. So the king of Uruk sends a messenger to the king of Arata with a threat, demanding allegiance. The messenger runs all the way up the mountains, delivers the message, but the king of Arata is not very impressed and sends the messenger back with a challenge. If the king of Uruk can meet the challenge, maybe then he will submit. The challenge is to transport grains in nets all the way up to the mountains. The king of Uruk thinks about this challenge. He has an idea. He takes grain and lets the grain sprout. And then he can put it in nets, and he gives it to the messenger, and he sends the messenger with the grain up to the mountains, says, "Here, I met your challenge, pledge your allegiance." But the king of Arata has no mind to do that, and sends the messenger back with another challenge that is met, and another challenge, and the messenger has to run back and forth quite some distance, and there we seem to be at an impasse. The king of Uruk, in the meantime, gets really angry because he has met three difficult challenges and still the king, the mountain lord of Arata, is not submitting. So he goes on an incredibly long and angry rant. And at this point, the messenger standing next to him panics because he can't remember the long rant. And it's at this moment, according to the story, that the king of Uruk takes some clay, puts the words, his words, his rant, onto the clay tablet, gives the clay tablet to the messenger. The messenger runs up one more time to the mountains, presents the king of Arata with the clay tablets, and says, "Here's the message." The king of Arata looks at the message, holds it to his ear, doesn't understand it, doesn't understand what's going on, can't understand how a clay tablet can hold language, and then in the face of his entire court, he submits to Uruk. So this is the story how these scribes imagined the invention of writing. It's purely a kind of diplomatic message. It's the first text message, if you will, in human history. And it has to do with power politics, with relation to a rival. It's sent by an imperial scribe of some sort. The messenger has become a scribe. The king sends the written message. So, and this is in fact historically true. In Mesopotamia, where the first writing is developed, In the first couple of hundred years, writing is used primarily for bureaucratic purposes. This is one of the first states that give rise to a state bureaucracy that keeps track of economic transactions and political messages, such as the one captured by this story. So writing, in other words, is invented by accountants, and it has nothing to do with literature. It's only after several hundreds of years that one of these accountants, one of these tax collectors, decides to use this new technology of writing for a completely different purpose, and that is to write down a story. And that, for me, is really the moment when literature, namely written story, begins. It's the intersection of storytelling, which had, of course, been going on everywhere. Wherever humans had lived, they had told stories orally and transmitted them orally from generation to generation. But at this moment, this long oral storytelling tradition intersects with this new writing technology. And this is, for me, this is the definition of literature: storytelling plus writing technology. And that's, if you will, the big bang of literature, and everything that happens afterwards, the history of written stories, begins with this intersection. Once this intersection happens, the most important stories get written down in each culture. In Mesopotamia, that will be the first important story to be written down. The first, what I call foundational epic, is the Epic of Gilgamesh. And it commemorates King Gilgamesh, who recreates the great city of Uruk. And I want you to imagine this as a city built out of clay. The great wall of Uruk is made out of clay bricks, and King Gilgamesh is presented as rebuilding that wall. The houses of Uruk in this first urban space are made of clay. Plumbing is made of clay. The food is transported from far afield into the city in clay pots. The potter's wheel is the first sort of sophisticated mechanical tool, really, that is used to produce these clay pots. But of all the uses of clay in this clay-based civilization, the most important is the one that I just described, namely to use clay and to press words onto clay. This is the Mesopotamian writing system, the first writing system, to press marks into clay, and this becomes the material onto which the Epic of Gilgamesh is written. So a clay city that celebrates the writing, clay-based cuneiform writing, and its great first story, the Epic of Gilgamesh, as the most important use to which clay has been put. And that, I think, captures just how important this culture deemed writing to be and how proud it was of this culture. So this is the first epic, but soon other writing cultures emerge, and something similar to what I have just described happens. Namely, writing enters a culture. It sometimes is primarily used first for accounting purposes, but very quickly now, with these long foundational stories get written down, so more and more writing cultures develop these foundational epics, like the Homeric epics and the Epic of Gilgamesh. And this is what I describe sort of the first stage of literature, these foundational epics that tell its listeners and its readers who they are, where they came from. Sometimes they include creation myths of the creation of the world, and provide entire cultures with a sense of cultural cohesion. So this is the first stage in the story of literature. The next stage, something interesting happens. And for me, the moment when the next stage is inaugurated takes place in Jerusalem. In Jerusalem, where Ezra, the scribe, has just led a group of exiled Jews from Babylonian exile back to the city of Jerusalem, which had been partially destroyed, and many of the Jews had been exiled. But now they are returning. Ezra the scribe is leading a group of returnees in order to rebuild the city walls in order to rebuild the temple and to reinstitute Judaism as a temple practice. But there's something else that Ezra brings with him from Babylonian exile. In Babylonian exile, the scriptures of these exiled people had become more and more important because they no longer had a king, there's no longer a temple for ritual practice, so the texts in which the stories of the Jews had been written down had become important in exile, and more stories had been added to them. And these stories now, Ezra the scribe, who had trained in Babylon, in the great Mesopotamian writing culture, is now bringing these texts back to Jerusalem. And then he does something important, and he plans it very carefully. He builds a stage, a wooden stage. He calls everyone together, and he takes the scrolls, the Torah scrolls, and he holds them up, and he demands that the assembled people bow before these scrolls and worship them as if they were a god. And at this moment in the story of literature, the idea of sacred scripture is invented. Of course, we are all very familiar with this idea of sacred scripture because that idea really caught on to the extent that I think today it's almost impossible for us to even imagine what a religion without a sacred scripture would be. And that's not just true of the three so-called religions of the book, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, but also of Hinduism, of Buddhism. Really, all religions today are based almost all on some idea of sacred scripture, very familiar to us. And so this is, if you will, the second stage, the second chapter in the story of literature, the idea of sacred scripture. The next stage takes a different turn. It's based on a whole pattern, on different kinds of what I call charismatic teachers that emerged in the ancient world within a few hundred years of each other in different writing-based cultures. Among these teachers, I count the Buddha in India, Confucius in China, Socrates in Greece, and Jesus in the Near East. As I said, they live in what's at the time the most literate cultures of their time. They could write, but they chose not to. Instead, they insist on live, interactive teaching. They assemble students and followers around them, and they engage in questions and answers. They live with their students. They answer questions. They exchange ideas with their students, and it's power. These are powerful ideas, power so powerful that students follow them, change their lives, because they all notice that there's something important happening around these charismatic teachers in India and China and Greece and the Middle East and in some other places. There are other such charismatic teachers. The teachings themselves are quite different from each other, but what they have in common is that these teachers could write but chose not to. But sooner or later, the inevitable happens and these teachers die. Some of them, like Confucius or the Buddha, die of natural causes. Others, like Socrates or Jesus, of a violent death. But either way, their students are now faced with an irretractable dilemma. They want to commemorate their teachers. They are convinced that their teachers are the most important figures and that their thoughts and deeds and words need to be somehow memorized and passed down. And yet these teachers refuse to write. And so there are oral traditions that start around these teachers, but sooner or later, some of these students do what their teachers deliberately didn't, namely they use writing and write down their teachers' words. And in some sense, you could say betray their teachers in that they use writing where their teachers had deliberately chosen not to. Socrates, of these four teachers I mentioned, Socrates is the one who is most explicit in his rejection of writing. So as writing spreads and becomes more important, you have these skeptics and critics of the new technology. And Socrates, in particular, will say that one of the things that he dislikes about writing is that you can't ask a text follow-up questions. You can't ask a text questions and probe the way you can a speaker. He also worries that the more we trust this external memory device, we no longer have to know things ourselves. So we are sort of outsourcing an important cognitive function. So various kinds of arguments are against writing, but then the students write down their teacher's words sooner and later because they consider it so important and they want to use this powerful technology of writing to write them down. But what's interesting about it is they know, of course, that their teachers had avoided writing. So what they do is they channel that avoidance, that skepticism with respect to writing back into the texts they now produce. And the way they do it is by not writing the kinds of texts that I described earlier, for example, these foundational epics, or texts like the Hebrew Bible, but much more vivid dialogic texts that show teachers in live interactions with their students, that describe these teachers as they lived and acted. And the result, some are outright, in the case of Plato, the student of Socrates, he creates outright dialogues, almost like plays. So these texts are much more vivid, if you will, than the older scriptures or the foundational epics. And that's part of their power. And some of these texts are also very canny now in using the most important revolutions in writing technology. And I want to just spend a little bit more time with that, because that's one of the through lines, really, of the book, how different writing technologies have shaped the written world. And that's that through line, that focus, is very much conceived of based on an experience we all share today, namely, we are really living in this unusual time when we are experiencing live, as it were, a true rare revolution in writing technologies, when profound changes happening around how we communicate with written words, who writes and for what purpose, and how we read and what kinds of stories get told in writing. And so one of the motivations for the book was to look back at these earlier moments when new writing technologies came along and transformed how we communicate with each other in writing. So these texts of these charismatic teachers now become some of the earliest adopters of new writing technologies. One text in particular I want to mention is the Diamond Sutra. It's one of the texts written by followers of the Buddha long after the master's death. And Buddhist monks transport this text from India to China, where it gets translated into Chinese. And it is in China that this text encounters two of the most important inventions in writing technology, namely paper and print, both invented first in China, and the earliest existing printed text in the world is the Diamond Sutra from 868, so long before Gutenberg invented, or we should really say reinvented, print in Northern Europe. The Diamond Sutra was printed in China and on paper. The reason why these new technologies are so important is because they radically lower the cost of producing literature. And if you lower the cost of literature, you allow more people entrance into the literary world, and therefore new kinds of stories to emerge, as well as older stories to become more prominent. And this is one of the patterns I detected by taking this bird's eye view of 400 years of literature, 4,000 years of literature. Namely that on the one hand, the most established canonical texts are often the early adopters of new writing technologies. The Buddhist Sutra, the Diamond Sutra, is a good example. The same will happen several hundred years later when Gutenberg reinvents print for Northern Europe, when one of the first texts, the first long text he prints, is the Latin Bible. So these established canonical sacred texts or texts of master teachers are often the texts that are in the best position to profit from these great new technologies. And these are also often texts that their believers, their readers, want to use to proselytize. So they are invested in replicating these texts and distributing them and proselytizing with them. One reason why print and paper, for example, are such excellent technologies for these texts. But as I said, the other effect of these new technologies is usually that more people can enter the literary world. That is, there are suddenly new readers and new writers, and that also means that there are new stories that get told. It's a kind of democratization, really, of the written world. And that happens whenever these new technologies come along. Happens in China with paper and print. And now paper gets adopted by the Arabic world next. There are very dramatic stories about how the Arabs had to extract the secret of papermaking from Chinese prisoners of war. We don't know whether these stories are true, but they record how important the idea of papermaking, the technique of papermaking, was considered to be. And Baghdad becomes the center of papermaking in the Arabic world. And it's in Baghdad that a new form of popular literature emerges that, if you will, is the beginning of a fourth stage in the story of literature, namely popular storytelling that now, for the first time, is written down. And the text for me that captures that best is a story collection from the Arabic world you all know, that we all grew up with, namely the Arabian Nights. The Arabian Nights is a very different kind of literature, yet again, from these earlier ones. It's a very loose story collections with hundreds of stories. The stories themselves come from far-flung places, as far as away as Persia and India and Greece, and these stories circulate on the Eurasian continent. The earliest paper fragment from the Arabic world is a fragment from the wonderful framing story of the Arabian Nights. And the Arabian Nights is just one of many of these story collections. Story collections really start to dominate the world of writing for many hundreds of years, all the way to the Middle Ages. And it becomes a way of collecting different kinds of stories that different readers can now enjoy and participate in, stories that get retold. And these story collections are also dynamic in that new stories can be added to them. Our current version of the Arabian Nights comes from the 18th century. So there are, over the hundreds of years, different stories were added to this framing story of Scheherazade and her sister and the king. And these framing stories become almost like storytelling machines, where you add new stories and you adapt them, and they're stories within stories. It's a real storytelling universe that's created, and one of the drivers, I would say, of that is paper. What's interesting about the Arabic world is they adopt paper to such great effect, but not print. These two technologies, both invented in China, separate. One travels to the Arabic world, and through the Arabic world and Arab-occupied Spain to Europe. The other, namely print, travels on the Silk Road through the Eurasian continent to Europe, and it is with Gutenberg in Northern Europe that these two inventions reconnect. And it's really that reconnection of paper and print that sets off the second great revolution in writing technologies, namely the print revolution in Northern Europe. So-called invented by Gutenberg, but really reinvented by Gutenberg, because Gutenberg was quite aware that there was some form of print that had happened in China. He was also lucky in that papermaking, the art of papermaking, had just arrived in Europe a few hundred years before, just in time so that his newly conceived printing press could really take off thanks to paper, because without a cheap writing surface, print would never have had the transformative effects it had in Northern Europe. And since then, we have been basically living in what some call the Gutenberg galaxy, namely a world shaped by the printing press. The first printing press in North America was right here in Cambridge, because, of course, the Puritans developed here the most literate society on earth. And I talk about the inheritance of that kind of book reading and printing culture all the way to Benjamin Franklin, who was what I would call the first print entrepreneur, in that he created a whole network, paper mills, newspapers and broadsheets and new forms of polemic. He even had control over the postal roads as postmaster general over which printed matter would be transported across the 13 colonies. And his greatest contribution to the American Revolution, I would say, was as a print entrepreneur. So this is essentially our world until recently, when a new revolution in writing technologies has been taking place all around it. And I won't make any predictions exactly what the effects of that will be, except that I think these two types of effects that happened earlier are also happening right now. Namely, on the one hand, a lot of the canonical literature is now much more widely available than ever before through such online platforms as Project Gutenberg or Internet Archive, right? So we really have now very easy access to the great store of world literature. And on the other hand, new forms of popular writing are emerging. We are just at the beginning of this writing revolution, so that I'm sure there are many more will emerge, but I'll just mention, for example, fan fiction is a very new form of writing in which readers suddenly become active as writers. And of course, short forms, Twitter. Twitter reminds me very much of that first message sent by the angry king of Uruk. Sometimes when Trump is tweeting to King Jong-un, I'm thinking of that exchange between the king of Uruk and the king of Arata. So there is certainly an explosion of popular writing. More people are reading and writing than ever before, and that's just will have profound new effects, and new forms and genres of writing are clearly developing in that context. But not everything is new. I'm also struck that some of the new forms that are ushered in by our revolution harken back to much earlier forms. One of them is the tablet, right? I started with the clay tablets on which the Epic of Gilgamesh was first written, and tablets had gone out of fashion for really thousands of years, replaced by the scroll and later by the book. And now, for the first time, we're writing on tablets again. I have in the book some images of scribes from the ancient world sitting cross-legged, looking at their tablets. And when I squint, they look very much like my students sitting cross-legged in the library, looking at their tablets. The other form that's returned is scrolling, right? We are scrolling again. We are scrolling down our screens, even though the scroll, which had been so important, which Ezra had held up as sacred scripture, had been replaced by the Roman invention of the book that I haven't had time to talk much about, a very convenient format that's easy to transport, that's easy to flip through. But now, because computers encode text as continuous text, they don't divide naturally into pages, we are scrolling down our screens again. So a lot is new, and I think there will be new, and there already are new forms of storytelling that are developing, but some of these techniques also, in an interesting way, go back to much earlier forms of storytelling from the 4,000 years of literature. Thank you.
You have been listening to How Storytelling Shaped the World, a Cambridge Forum event being recorded live in Harvard Square with Martin Puchner. We are co-sponsored by the Lowell Institute, the Mass Cultural Council, and Friends of the Cambridge Forum. Thanks for joining us, and please come again.